As the country bounces back from the worst recession in recent history, parts of the Rocky Mountain West are still suffering. For instance, the town of Hanna, Wyoming, a little town on the state's windswept plains. For years, it had only one grocery store, the Hanna Food Mart. Late last month, the store closed. It's a blow to a town where jobs are scarce and where a snowstorm can close roads for days at a time. Wyoming Public Radio's Molly Missick has the story.
A few days before his store is scheduled to shut down, Andy Jones surveys the aisles at the Hanna Food Mart. He's stocked and swept and managed the place for a decade, but now the store is emptying out.
As you can see, there's not much left on the shelves right now. The frozen is pretty well gone.
These last days at the store have become a kind of grim countdown. Ever since Andy and his wife Sandy Jones gave their sales and expenses a hard look and decided they could no longer sell groceries in Hanna, Wyoming. Andy says the tipping point came quickly, as soon as the bad national economy started affecting local jobs.
Maybe the last half of last year is when it really started dropping off. And every time a town loses one business, it's more reason for the people to go out of town. So it hurts all the rest of the businesses.
The business that hurt Andy was the gift shop across the parking lot. It closed sometime last summer. And the business Andy hurts by closing his doors is a local bar and restaurant called Dingy Dan's. Lois Buchanan owns it with her husband.
We're to the point we want to put our house on the market and leave. It's not fun living here anymore.
With the Hanna Food Mart gone, there will be nowhere in town to buy bread or milk. There's not even a regular gas station in Hanna, just a couple of credit card-only gas pumps. A simple mini-mart is 20 miles away. The nearest grocery store will be an 80-mile drive round trip. But a lot of people in Hanna don't get around that easily.
It's bad.
June Webster is one of them.
I mean, I walk to the store maybe 2-3 times a day. And we don't go out of Dodge.
Webster is 82, and her husband's health isn't good. For them, losing the store doesn't only mean they'll need help getting groceries. It also means more isolation. It's a thought that brings June Webster to tears.
I told our kids that our phone system, it's so much static. And the television, oh, goodness, we have to keep calling, telling them that it's off. And I said, now our store is closed. And the kids said, I'd move. They want us to come home so bad. But this is home.
This town hasn't been well off since the 1970s, the last time its coal mines were going strong. More and more, it seems like there's not much reason to have a town where Hanna sits. Still, there are families that have been here for generations. A lot of people retired to Hanna after mining dropped off and houses got cheap. Altogether, 800 people call this town home. By the afternoon, workers have come to pick up the big glass-front soda cooler that used to sit by the food mart's front door.
1287. All righty, have a good one. Might not see you again.
Business is brisk, the way it's been since Andy and Sandy Jones announced they were going under and put pretty much the whole place on sale. Lorinda Schizel will lose her cashier's job, but she says she's not going to worry yet.
Well, I'm going to rest for a while. I'll have to look for something else. My husband's disabled, and we can't live on his Social Security. We can't.
As for losing the grocery store, she says she'll start baking at home the way she used to.
Oh, I made bread yesterday and made 2 dozen tortillas. Yeah, we're all going to have to get back to basics.
For NPR News, I'm Molly Messick.
And whatever you may think of bankers and their bonuses or their high wages, modern society would not function without the financial industry.
You can't have sustained social and economic development without money, without commerce. It's an incredibly effective servant if it's allowed to operate in the right ways as a servant. It becomes very dangerous when it's a master.
Stephen Green knows something about money and commerce. He's chairman of one of the biggest banks in the world, HSBC. He's also an ordained minister in the Church of England. He's written a book called Good Value, Reflections on Money, Morality, and an Uncertain World. He joined us to talk about how it's possible to bring together money and morality. Good morning.
Renee, good morning.
What, in your view, was the moral component, or perhaps lack of a moral component, that led to the financial crisis that we are now struggling with, other than what people talk about all the time or think about, and that's just plain greed?
I think greed is one way of describing it, of course, but I'd make two points. First of all, I think it is important to understand that the crisis didn't come out of nowhere. It came out of a global macroeconomy which was getting increasingly imbalanced. Within that context, you had a kind of atmosphere that spread around that sort of said to itself, if I've got a product, if there's a market, if it's legal and I've got a contract, I don't have to ask any other questions about suitability, fairness, rightness. Now, I don't think any of us really think that's an adequate way of going about our business lives, but there's no doubt that that attitude, that atmosphere, has become more and more pervasive in recent times, and that is something we need to face up to and address.
Well, you know, one blind spot that the banks seem to have had in this past year as countries are emerging or trying to emerge from this crisis had to do with bonuses. Average people have been angered and insulted even by the whole notion that big bonuses are still being given out. How did the bonus debate play out at your bank, HSBC?
Well, it is entirely understandable that there's widespread public anger in circumstances where not only were there those distortions, but they led to inappropriate risk-taking and in some cases to institutional collapse with all of the consequences that we're all aware of. We have to face up to that and accept it. The important way forward is to properly align the interests of the trader with the shareholder and the wider public interest. And then I'm enough of a believer in the way the markets operate to believe that that when they're effectively operating, you then need to reward real performance with proper pay that is properly competitive and taking into account market trends.
Is there a way to run a bank that would not so much not need regulations? That would be sort of utopian, but
that would be utopian, yes.
I mean, yeah, in a sense that would keep itself in better order.
I know what you're getting at. And I think the answer, in one way the answer is yes and the other is no. Yes, it's extremely important. There's a real responsibility on the part of boards of companies in general, not just banks, I think all companies, to ensure that there is a culture within the organization and permeates the organization and is constantly refreshed and nurtured, which emphasizes the importance of doing the right thing. The responsibility of a board is not to maximize the profits of the next quarter or the next half or the next year. The responsibility of the board is to grow the business on the basis of a sustainable business model for the foreseeable future. And you do that, one, by providing good service to customers on a transparent, open basis, two, by having engaged, committed employees, and three, by ensuring, and this is increasingly important with every year that goes by, a real attention to the community responsibilities of the business. That's true for banks. It's true for any other kind of company. Now, when I started off, I said yes and no. What I meant by the no bit is that I do not believe the markets are capable of being self-policing. I think the big learning of this crisis is that the markets are not reliably self-policing, and you do need government-supported regulatory environment, which is constructive and effective in watching out for the weaknesses that are sometimes endemic to the system.
You know, what would you say, talking to younger people who are going into banking, want to go into banking, what would you say to them should be their purpose?
I think I would say a couple of things to them. I would say your purpose should be to provide good services in this particular chosen field of expertise. It is an area of expertise that humanity can't do without. The second thing I would add to that is, what's more for you personally, if you feel drawn to this, you ought to be able to ask yourself the question, is this what I am meant to be doing? I have only one life. I have one working life, probably. Maybe that's not so true these days. What is certainly true is I have one life. Is this what I want to spend, what will turn out to be quite a lot of your creative energy and potential, doing? That's what I think we should ask ourselves.
Stephen Green is an ordained minister as well as the chairman of HSBC Bank. His new book is Good Value: Reflections on Money, Morality, and an Uncertain World.
The recession may be easing slightly, but states across the country continue to face eye-popping budget deficits. States are cutting deep into public health programs, and dental benefits for Medicaid recipients are at the top of the list. In California, it's been 7 months since some 3 million poor and disabled adults lost their dental coverage. Sarah Varney of member station KQED reports on how dentists and their patients are responding.
In thousands of dentist offices and community clinics in California, from the Rocky North Coast to the Mexican border, it's the receptionists who are left to counsel and console patients who've lost their benefits.
They will come here crying. They need help.
Claudia Rico is a receptionist at Clínica de Salud Valle Salinas, a safety net dental clinic in the central coast town of Salinas. She says more and more patients are showing up each day with swollen gums and infected teeth. Prior to the state budget cuts, Medicaid patients here could get annual exams, cleanings, and, if needed, root canals in order to save their teeth. Now, Claudia says, patients can't afford to pay for root canals themselves, even at the discounted rate of $600. So they end up getting their teeth pulled.
They'd rather take it out because they don't have the money. It's either rent, food, or dental work, and they opt for the most convenient, well, inconvenient for them, but the only thing they can do to relieve their pain.
In interviews with dozens of dentists and safety net clinics around California, providers say patients are foregoing routine cleanings and delaying care until the pain is unbearable. Dentists are offering discounts and payment plans, but they say few patients can afford them. Dental schools and free clinics are overrun, and some private dental offices and at least one community dental clinic have closed. Federal law considers dental an optional benefit that states don't have to provide when insuring poor or disabled residents. In fact, at least seven states, Virginia, Delaware, Alabama, Texas, Colorado, Utah, and Missouri, provide absolutely no coverage, even for emergency relief of pain and infection. And a growing number of states have scaled back their programs and cover dental emergencies only. Julia Paradise is a Kaiser Family Foundation health researcher.
In the last recession and in this recession, and when states are under severe budget strains, dental benefits for adults, since they are an optional benefit, are among the first things to go.
In California, the state will still pay to have a tooth pulled in an emergency, but it no longer covers the cost of expensive dentures. That's a big problem for seniors. Medicare doesn't cover dental, so poor seniors in California have long relied on state dental benefits when they need dentures. Lucretia Renteria runs the Mendocino Coast Clinic in Fort Bragg, a hardscrabble fishing and lumber town.
Their nutritional needs of the patient can't be met if you can't chew and eat food appropriately. So we have patients who suffer from a form of anorexia or have to have soft foods only.
The mouth has long been an orphaned organ, says Burton Edelstein, a Columbia University professor of dentistry and health policy. When Medicaid and Medicare were created in 1965, Edelstein says oral health was not well understood, and Congress didn't think to mandate dental coverage.
It reflected policymakers' misunderstanding that the mouth is not part of the body and that oral health is not an important component of general health.
That has largely changed. Over the last decade, federal public health agencies have aggressively promoted oral health and its connection to diabetes, stroke, and heart disease. Oral health advocates say the cancellation of dental coverage for poor and disabled adults in California and elsewhere around the country comes just as they were gaining ground on dental disease. But Michael Byrd from the National Conference of State Legislatures says it will be a long time before states restore optional benefits like dental coverage.
The fiscal downturn is so severe that even if you were to raise taxes or fees, you still aren't going to be able to plug all the holes that exist right now. This is all about saving part of the school year versus the early release of prisoners versus an optional dental program versus whether you're going to be able to fill the potholes on the roads.
Byrd says state coffers are empty and all the easy choices were made long ago. For NPR News, I'm Sarah Varney.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.
Now, a vote in the Senate last night did not break down entirely on partisan lines. Five Republicans in the Senate sided with nearly all of the Democrats to vote for a jobs creation bill. One of those who broke ranks with the Republican Party was the man who last month ended the Democrats' 60-vote majority, Massachusetts Republican Scott Brown. Here's NPR's David Wellner.
The jobs bill Republicans were trying to hold up is modest by congressional standards. Its $15 billion price tag is only about one-tenth what a separate jobs bill cost that the House passed late last year. But to hear California Democrat Barbara Boxer tell it before yesterday's vote, The fate of the nation was in the hands of a chamber whose majority party now has only 59 members, one short of the 60 needed to break a filibuster.
This vote will send a shiver through the spine of our entire business community and our working people if we don't get 60 votes today.
Failing to get to 60 might have also sent a shiver through Senate Democrats. This was, after all, the very first filibuster they were trying to break on a bill since Massachusetts Republican Scott Brown became his party's 41st senator. As such, it was a crucial test of Majority Leader Harry Reid's skill at winning over at least a few Republicans. Reid told them they now share some of the responsibility for what happens in the Senate.
If Republicans support this bill, as they have all the elements of it in the past, and if they join us to pass it, we're going to do many more bills just like this to create jobs. However, if my friends on the other side of the aisle want to put partisanship ahead of people, people are out of work, they once again try to distract from the issue at hand, they only confirm their reputation, the party of no. They only confirm the American people's fears that Republicans refuse to do things to help them.
Republicans had wanted a bigger jobs bill with more tax breaks. Minority Leader Mitch McConnell was the only Republican to address the politically charged measure on the Senate floor. But rather than criticize it, he spoke of the deficit.
Americans are worried about the growing national debt. That's why Republicans hope to offer amendments to the jobs bill that we'll be voting on today that would lower it.
For newly sworn-in Massachusetts Republican Scott Brown, it was his first chance to uphold a GOP filibuster on a piece of legislation. Instead, Brown voted to end the filibuster. He later told reporters he hoped his vote could be what he called a strong step toward restoring bipartisanship in Washington.
I felt it was appropriate. Like I said, it's not a perfect bill. I would have liked broader and deeper tax cuts, but I was comfortable with that first vote.
Maine's Olympia Snow was one of four other Republicans who also voted to end the filibuster. She said she welcomed Brown as one more Republican willing to consider legislation on its merits.
Frankly, I think we've been so driven here between red and blue states rather than, you know, really focusing on what matters for America.
Nebraska's Ben Nelson was the only Democrat who voted against ending the filibuster. That state's Republican Senator Mike Johanns voted likewise.
I just don't see anything there that causes me to get excited about what Senator Reid is trying to accomplish here.
Reid, for his part, exulted in the 62-30 outcome of the vote and the willingness of five Republicans to break with their party.
It's really a new day, and I look forward to this work period being one where we can all go home and say, you know, ladies and gentlemen from Nevada and New Hampshire and Illinois and New Jersey and New York and Arkansas, we're working together. We're really getting things done together. And that's what legislation should be about.
Having found an issue that can divide Republicans, Reid then promised two more jobs-related bills for later this week. David Wellner, NPR News, The Capitol.